The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, number 89 for January 22nd, 2007.
Sound awfully chipper today, John. How are you?
Greetings, folks.
There it is. I knew you'd do that for me.
I missed it. Hi, Dave. How are you? This is John Braun, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Hamilton.
How are you?
Wow, that's just all reversed, man. I can't handle that.
It's bass ackwards. I'm all drugged up today. In the interest of full disclosure, I have a cold, and so I'm taking the new recipe of Dayquil. Which doesn't have Sudafed in it anymore, or Sudafedrine or whatever it is.
Right,
because that's a precursor to methamphetamine or whatever. So it's got this phenylephrine in it, and I don't know. It doesn't have a lot of side effects, which is good. It doesn't, like, dry me out too much, but I'm thinking that's kind of a problem. So
that's good. And full disclosure here, I have a nice Dogfish Head 120-minute IPA sitting here.
Oh, boy.
For the beer connoisseurs out there. One is all you need.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we have all kinds of stuff to go through tonight. We've got some answers about Doris's magical rebooting iMac, and then we've got some more thoughts about the Geek Challenge that we posed last week about iTunes. I'm not sure that we are finished with that yet. And some new questions that are actually going to be a whole lot of fun. So let's get right to it and listen to what Chad had to say about Doris's magical rebooting iMac.
Greetings, gentlemen. This is Chad from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm calling in regards to Doris's problem on episode number 88. Doris had the G5 iMac that was flickering, shutting down, all sorts of bad things. You two had both suggested it might potentially be hardware. I can almost definitely suggest that it's hardware. A very good friend of mine and her fiancé were having similar problems with their iMac G5. Very similar problem. After some pressure from me, they finally took it into their local Genius Bar, and they actually took the machine with them. The Genius laid it down, flipped it open, and instantly identified the problem. It was, as he suspected, bulging capacitors, which is just as bad as it sounds.
Bulging capacitors. That's crazy. All right, let's, sorry, we'll let Chad finish here.
If Doris is still under Apple care, I highly recommend she take it in. Essentially, they paid completely for sending it off. It required replacing the logic board. If she's no longer on Apple care, I'd still take it to the Apple store, find out what the cost is. It's probably going to be less than a new iMac. That's my suggestion, and have a good day. Bye.
Yeah, and of course, Chad was not the only one to send something in about this. There were many, many, many of you, Robert, I believe, and a couple of others. It is a known issue. There was a repair extension program issued by Apple for this, so we've put a link in the show notes this week. I think, John, you actually put a link in the show notes last week for it as well.
Last week, yes, because we had the write-ins, and absolutely every now and then, you know, Apple has a little,
there's problems.
You know, a little problem. There are problems, and that they, so that's why that happened. They may not have explicitly said, "Oh, this is under a repair program." But you know, they'll do you good. Now it's funny because I do remember back in the good old Apple II days. If you remember, the disk controller had a connector that wasn't keyed.
Oh, that's right.
And I remember the same phenomenon. You may have seen this. And the problem was, if you put the connector one pin off, which you could do because they weren't using very sophisticated or keyed connectors.
Right.
Instead of introducing 5 volts to the capacitor that wanted 5 volts, you would give it 12 volts. And it wasn't so much the bulging capacitor as it was the exploding capacitor.
As I like to say, when you would do that, it would let the magic smoke out of the capacitor. And, of course, all electronics run on magic smoke. And if you let...
Well, why do you say that?
Because I've seen it. Because the electronics work, right? And then as soon as you let the magic smoke out, it doesn't work anymore.
Or in the case of caps, the magic stuffing.
The magic inside. Stuffing. That's
but
right.
That's definitely, so that definitely points to
you want all that stuff to stay in there. That's right.
Yeah, so that's definitely a power supply problem, I would say, in that it was providing a little too much juice to those caps, and they were getting kind of upset.
Yeah. All right.
So, now I wonder if, I mean, Apple does include, with a lot of machines, something called Apple hardware tests. Now, I haven't followed the latest
I don't think that would test for this. It's a power supply issue. Yeah, I don't, or a power controller issue or something. But
well, actually, you know, I guess it was doing its job. It detected something was wrong, and it shut off.
Yeah, that's true.
The power supply detected it was going out of spec and something was wacky, and maybe it zapped a few things, but it shut off before it did any real damage and, you know, burned the house down. So it sounded like it was doing what it should, and there was a replacement program. Good news.
So, yeah. So thank you, everyone who wrote in. And I want to, actually, along those lines, I wanted to just say very quickly, when I'm going through the Geek Gab email box, as I do usually on Fridays or Mondays prepping for the upcoming show, I do read all the emails that come in. I try to reply to the ones, all of them that I can that make sense to. But if you do get a reply from me, it's short. It's not short because I'm being short with you. It's simply short because I'm short on time. And so please excuse me if there's any that come across as me being less than friendly. It actually is quite the opposite. I'm pleased as punch to get all these emails, really humbled actually that we get all this stuff from you folks, but it's a lot, and it is a lot to go through. So
yep. And I take a peek every now and then. And I got to say, yeah, like at Macworld, I wasn't sure if Dave was there. No, because he's such a popular guy. He was all over the place. I mean, it was crazy.
It was crazy. Yeah. So. All right. So now we will move on to the Geek Challenge. And the Geek Challenge, the current one that we have in front of us is, last week we played a comment by a guy with an NAS-based, network-based storage device on which he stores his iTunes library. And he wants all of his Macs to see this library, or at least see all the songs in this library with just the one copy of the songs. There's a couple of, I don't believe we're there yet, but we'll see if we're getting a little bit closer.
Yeah, and just toss in NAS storage, think network drive. So he's basically got a drive that multiple computers in his household can see.
Right.
And so I think there's a convenience thing. But NAS is network attached storage, and that seems to be a trend. It's kind of like a file server, but you don't need a computer. It's a drive enclosure that has some smarts, and all the computers on your network potentially can see it and share. And I think he had an HP one.
Yeah.
And I've seen, you know, Maxter and a few other guys introduce these, and they look pretty slick. But anyways, we had a few suggestions, so back to you.
Hello, John and Dave. My name is John from New Jersey. I just got done listening to your podcast, number 88, and I think I have an answer to your Geek Challenge question about the iTunes. If you use something like ChronoSync, you can grab the two small files that iTunes keeps in its own folder and just push those across the other three Macs and across the network, and then the other Macs would then know what songs are in what folder, what folders are in what directories, and where the folders and songs will all lie. Just an idea. All right. Thanks for the podcast. Love the show. Bye.
Thanks, John. Yeah, that would work, but there's a couple of things. One Mac would always have to be the master on that, or at the very least with ChronoSync, I believe it's smart enough to go and grab the most recent version of that file and share it all around. The problem there, of course, being that if you... If you modify the file in two places between syncs, you're going to lose the changes in one of them, right? We're not talking about actually syncing the contents of the XML file. And really, that's what we need to do here is it needs to be smart enough to go and grab the actual contents of that XML file and parse them. And so maybe that's the angle to head down. Is there anything that's smart enough to do that? I don't know.
Now, there's two to get back to the two files specifically, for those that are curious, in your iTunes folder, you will see, as they pointed out, we have iTunesMusicLibrary.xml, and then we have another file next to it, iTunes Library. And I think those are the two files that he's talking about, the ones that are kind of the I'm not sure why they have two files instead of one.
Right.
Just kind of wacky. But those two files, I'm looking at my configuration right now, and they both have the exact same time date stamp, in addition to iTunes Music, which I think is where all your good stuff is.
Where the actual song files are. That's right. Yeah.
So those two files, I would say the combination of the two, again, why are there two? iTunes Music Library XML and just iTunes Library point to all of your music. So just want to clarify that.
All right. But Matt did have an interesting point to make here. So we'll switch to this.
Hi, my name is Matt Mendick, calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I had a possible answer to the question that the guy asked, I don't remember his name, about the network attached storage and iTunes, library syncing and whatnot. My idea was to save the library of the main, you know, host computer on the network attached storage, and then when you start iTunes on all the four computers, you press shift to load that library directly from the network attached storage so that all four computers are loading the same library and they'll have access to the same songs in the right places and whatever. So I don't have the equipment to test that, but it's just an idea. Maybe that'll work. Thanks. Have a good one. Bye.
All right. Now, when I tested this earlier today, I was almost certain that I used the shift key and was successful, but...
almost.
But John pointed out to me that I don't believe that I was successful because...
I think it was the drugs, man.
You may be right. Yeah. I'll actually agree with you on that one. It's the option key, right? Is that what you found, John?
Alt or option key will bring up a dialog saying, choose iTunes library, just as if it couldn't find them. And you can either quit, create library, which that's kind of interesting, or what's the default, choose library, which then you point to... the folder that has your library, and there you go. So that ties into the thing.
There's a caveat there, though, because you can't have more than one file, more than one user accessing that library at the same time if you do it that way. What that would do, though, is totally solve this problem. So, your play counts would be updated. Any playlist changes you made would be reflected. Obviously, anything you imported or removed from the library would be there because it's just one file. We're not talking about syncing anything. We're talking about one copy of the library and then different computers pointing to it at different times. And that's the key, is at different times. So
now, why do you say that? Have you tried to it once and will one complain saying what file and user or something?
I haven't.
Are you just going on intuition that...
I'm going on intuition and what I've read that...
Which I would concur with you.
Yeah, that these files aren't meant to be shared, and if you have two instances of iTunes pointing at the same file, I think you risk corruption of those very files that we talked about, those two files, so...
Yeah, and I could see that maybe you add something on one, they update the file, then the other, and then... all of a sudden, they have different views of reality.
Yeah, my guess is that the file is they store bits and pieces of that file in memory and assume that the disk is not going to change underneath them. Who knows? But if anybody has any experience with that, please let us know.
Yeah, I may try it. Okay. I got two computers. You got two computers. Well, we'll try it if anybody has. But, we're going on our gut here, which is that, multiple people accessing these files that are important for iTunes to understand what its world looks like is a bad thing.
Yeah.
But hey, maybe they
make a
nice
backup, John.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, at least if your iTunes index files there, if not the whole thing. So
yeah, I'd shoot a backup of the whole thing before you start messing with it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
All right. So Noah had actually written an email that covered a couple of those options as well. And then Daniel wrote in with an automator action that basically, and I put a screenshot of it up, it's just two steps in the automator action. The screenshot is already in the show notes. You don't need to wait for them to be complete. It will be there by the time you hear this. And the screenshot shows you that it just scans whatever folder he's got out on the network and then imports those into whatever playlist you choose into iTunes. The problem with this is... he's got it, I believe, scanning the folder and saying, find me any files that were added since yesterday. And the problem is it will do exactly that every time you run it. So if you run it three times today, it will import the same files three times. So there may be some add-ons to Automator that make it a little bit smarter, and we're kind of hoping that somebody will stumble onto this. We're feeding as much information out there because... Well, frankly, we know how this troubleshooting process goes. You know, you see a problem and you think, okay, yeah, I know the parameters there. And then you start kind of just throwing other things into the mix. Think of it as a, and I hate the word, but think of it as a group brainstorming session. So we're just throwing all this data out there, hoping that it will catch with one of you and you'll say, oh, wait a minute. I hadn't thought about it before, but when you said X, I thought Y, bam, there you go. Or maybe it's just the drugs.
Bam.
Bam. That's right. Our sponsor this week is Audio Engine, and I am going to let it very strange that we got an audio comment in about Audio Engine, so we're going to break from form here and let this roll.
Hi, John and Dave. I have a question for you.
Bear with us. This gets better.
Speakers. I was wondering about getting the Audio Engine 5, but I have some questions about them.
Number one, will they work with my MacBook?
Number two, will they work with my 4th generation iPod?
Number 3, I think you have them. Do you like them? Are there any problems with them?
I love the show and remember...
Don't get cut.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Let us know. We got a mini challenge. Let us know which voices... were used. Which
That's right.
There synthesizer you go. Voices were used to make that.
All right. So these are the Audio Engine speakers. Will they work with the MacBook? Absolutely. They'll work with any Mac. They have a standard audio in port, the little 1/8-inch port. They come with a cable to plug into your Mac's audio out jack. So absolutely. For the same reason they'll work with the iPod, you plug it into the headphone jack and the iPod and you plug it into this. Do I like them? One of the things we try not to do with the ads is just offer blathering endorsements of the product. But yeah, absolutely. I love them. You heard me talk about them before they were a sponsor. These are the best speakers I've ever had on my desk. So be that as
likewise.
It may. Yeah.
I like to turn them up to 11.
That's right. Yeah, they do. They're very...
And they go to 11.
Yeah.
It's one of the few sets of speakers I've seen where you can crank it all the way to the maximum setting and you don't risk destroying them. These guys know what they're doing. You can, and it doesn't sound terrible either. I mean, it, I don't know what they're doing inside of there, but you get loud, not distorted, yep. Which I think you get from some, you know, cheapies.
The A5 speakers from AudioEngineUSA.com.
Awesome.
Yep. Okay, so 206-666-GEEK is the number to call, and thank you, Toby.
Oh, that's also 4335.
4335. That's correct.
Right.
All right. So it is time to move on to some new questions. And we're going to get right into the geeky thick of it here. And hopefully I'm not in too much of a fog to navigate us out of that thick. But either way, we're going to go.
Hey, Dave and John. It's Barrett, a.k.a. Mr. X from Tonawanda again. Quick question for you. Got an external hard drive. It was previously FireWire 800, but I didn't get an adapter cable because I ran out of PCI slots and I forsake the FireWire 800 for SATA. Anywho, with my internal SATA drive, it's on the PCI bus, and so is my external drive. I previously thought it was a very eloquent solution. Not eloquent, not a good word, but it was a very good solution that I had a primary drive through ATA, and then I could send the data. I could talk to the external drive, and it was just passing straight through the bus, or it would go over FireWire. Oops, my radio from work, calling on break. Anywho, now they're both on the PCI bus. Is there any sort of, if I go from disk to disk, is there a possibility that there's a problem, like with previously people would put two CD burners on one ATA bus, and on slower machines you would get pops and skips because you were saturating the bus, or there was data was bumping into each other. I know that's a very untechnical point, but didn't know if there's anything about that. All right, thanks again. Bye.
Okay, so very important to differentiate between the different types of ATA, right? The old type, which has now been retroactively called parallel ATA, allowed for two devices on each bus. initially called a master and slave, really then just called device zero and device one, because neither device was the master of the bus. In more recent incarnations, it was actually the host controller that controlled what, you know, what device got to talk when. The important thing to know about ATA is parallel or serial is that only one device can talk on one bus at a time. So what and there's some contention here between John and I if our caller's name is Barrett or Ferret, and so I'm going to say Barrett. But what Barrett said was,
I thought it was a nickname, maybe. I don't know.
It could be. Yeah, who knows? What Barrett said was, in the old days, if you had two CD burners or even a hard drive and a CD burner on the same bus, so one master and one slave, you could get disk skips and problems. And the reason for that is most host controllers weren't smart enough to do anything other than one device instruction after another. So if it sent an instruction to a CD-ROM drive, it doesn't matter how fast the bus is, doesn't matter how fast the hard drive is on, you know, the other hard drive is on that bus, we're now waiting for that CD burner to answer our query, right? In fact, the quickest turnaround you're going to get is when you're getting data back and forth. But it's a very chatty protocol, right? So there's a lot of other things happening. Are you ready? Where are you? That kind of thing. And all of those, if you've got a slower device like a CD drive, you send out the question or the query, and then the bus sits there and does nothing until it gets the answer back. Yeah.
So you're saying that's what I'm going to call an atomic operation. Can't be split. So you do something.
But the spec says that it can be, right? In later versions, I think ATA 4 or maybe ATA 5 or later, it can be. Okay. But again, it's up to
clarify
the,
that.
It's up to the host controller, i.e. the chip on the motherboard or the chip on the add-in card, to do that. And most of them did not support the queuing and all of the other parameters that were built into ATA 4 and greater. Basically, all these manufacturers would do was say, yeah, we'll support the larger drive sizes, you know, supported by the larger by the newer incarnations of ATA. And you know what, all these other specs, all these other parts to the spec, that not that important. The drives work, so we're good to go. So that's what would happen with what's now called parallel ATA. Serial ATA, which is what's in all or most of the new Macs.
Are we going to call that SATA or SATA?
SATA.
What's
yeah.
the SATA? Is SATA. That the cool kids I think say it that way?
That's what all the kids they're calling it. That's right. SATA only supports one device per bus, so it's not an issue. It does. It suffers from all the same problems. You have to wait for an answer before you can send out the next command, et cetera, et cetera. But since SATA only supports one device per bus, it's irrelevant. Now, why is it less? Well, in the old days, you typically would have one IDE bus in the very old days in a computer, and so they'd say, well, let's at least modify that bus or make it so that that bus can support two drives and we're good to go. Now, that's not an issue. I mean, computers are coming with 3 and 4 IDE buses in them. So when they started putting SATA buses in the computer, they figured, well, let's just cut this slave drive off the bus and bam. And so now it's a lot more efficient. So to answer your question, Barrett, no, it's not going to be a problem with Time Machine, because you're going to have multiple buses in your machine. If you hook up a second internal SATA drive, it is totally separate from any other SATA drive in that computer, effectively.
Okay.
Okay?
Gotcha.
I made it.
The one thing awesome, man. The one thing I want to mention, though, just to look at the relative performance issues here, is that, so I did a bit of poking around. SATA claims to go up to 150 megabytes a second.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you with me on that?
Okay, yeah.
Are you cool with that?
Megabytes a second, yeah, okay.
Yeah, whereas you have things, and I'm going to link to an article. One of the sites that I like for, you know, figuring out hardware is Tom's Hardware. Have you been there?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Yeah, so I got this from there. Now, it's not the fastest. I guess there's, you know, especially some high-end SCSI buses that can go like 320 and all that. But the thing to keep in mind is that one of the dynamics that's pretty constant, at least for now, is that the drives max out internally, getting from the platter to the bus on the drive to about 60 to 80. So you kind of have that dynamic going where even if the drive is performing at peak efficiency, it's nowhere near the speed of the bus that it's talking on. So I guess you and I were chatting earlier, and I think there's a potential that you could probably, you know, because the drive is relatively slower than the bus, depending on, I think, as you pointed out, if the chip and the, you know, the controller can deal with this, because the drives aren't as fast as the bus, maybe you can, you know, kind of talk to maybe two at the same time and not take too much of a big hit.
If the controller's smart enough to do it, yeah.
To say, okay, you. But as you mentioned, a lot, you know, and I can see this from a development point of view. You want to get lazy, you say, okay, I'm going to send out a command. I'm going to hang out and wait for somebody to talk back to me. And in the meantime,
nobody's doing anything.
La, 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 la. Which is easy programming, but not efficient. So
that's right. Okay.
There you go.
Dan has a question. We talked about retrospect last week, and Dan has a question about it. So onward we go.
Hello, John and Dave. This is Dan from Tampa, Florida. I was just listening to number 88 this week, and one of the references you made about backups and retrospect kind of concerned me, because one of the questions I had about retrospect and using it with an external drive is that, if I recall correctly, it requires a separate partition for each backup volume. Therefore, if you wanted to run a 7-day rotation, for example, you'd have to create 7 separate partitions for retrospect to be able to use those for each of the backup volumes. I'm a longtime user of retrospect in enterprise environment, but typically with tapes, and this was something that I encountered when I got a copy for personal use and was planning on using it on one of my Macs. I'd appreciate if you'd address that if you can, because I do currently use Mac backup, although I typically do full backups rather than incremental, so the incremental issue was not a problem for me.
All right.
I'm with that. Just to interject,
yeah,
I much prefer making full backups because I don't trust the machine to do it properly.
Yeah, well, if you've got the time.
Now that I...
Yeah.
All right,
If you're backing up over a network, though, full backups every day don't make sense.
Yeah.
So, there you go. Depending on the amount of data you're backing up. So, that being said, no, you do not have to use a separate partition or separate volume for every backup set in retrospect. You certainly can. And as you found with tapes, you know, that obviously works just fine. But what you can do is do a file set based backup, and that will save, and you can save it anywhere you want. So you could pick one backup drive and save 7 days worth of backups to it, and each one would just appear as a separate file. That's it. One file for the backup and then a catalog file, which you normally store somewhere else. So now I wouldn't recommend doing that. If you're going to do backups, I would actually do them on different drives for the sake of redundancy and safety, but you certainly do not have to, and you can have other things on that drive. You could have 4 different backups from different things. It's just a file, like a Word document or anything else. So check out file sets in retrospect if you're looking to do that. Like I said, I've been using retrospect for over a decade. The interface is backwards as they come, but once you learn it, you know, it's the classic thing. Instead of it working to think the way you want to think, you have to work to think the way it wants you to think. And that is what I consider a design flaw, a UI flaw. No, seriously. I mean, software shouldn't force you to think a different way, but retrospect does. However, once you've adapted, it you're good to go. So
I was going to say it's the Windows of the backup world.
Bingo. Right. Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it does work. So there you go.
Yeah. So should we do Dave
we'll
or
do,
Steven?
We'll do both of Dave's, actually. Dave sent in 2 questions, so we'll do one at a time, and then we'll end with Steven here. So,
hi, Dave and John. This is Dave from Columbus. I've got 2 questions for you. The first one is, I was backing up some home movies that I had converted from VHS to digital, and the file was, or the project in iMovie, was about 96 gig or so. So I have 2 external USB hard drives, copied it from one to the other. And then the source drive, the original drive that I had, started acting a little flaky. in my iMac, it started reporting the size as 1.1 terabytes, but every single check that I ran on it, with a couple of downloadable tools from Mac Update, Disk Warrior, Disk Utility, and so forth, said nothing's wrong. So I'm curious about that. That's my first question. My second question is, on the drive that I copied that 96 gig file to, whenever I went and opened up the project, it said that you know, it was somehow corrupted and it didn't work. So I'm suspecting that something's wrong with the first drive, but whenever I you can right click on it and view content, everything seemed to be there. Everything was fine, everything looked great. Anyway, if you give me your thoughts on that, thanks. Bye.
All right. Well, let's answer the second half first. Yeah, I would assume that you've got a corrupted source file, and therefore any copies of it are going to give you trouble. So that my guess is that despite the fact that you see the files there, perhaps the files themselves aren't complete or you know, based on a damaged copy. So it sounds like the drive is horked, man. I mean, I think that's
horked?
I think that's the technical term. Yeah.
And it sounds like a key part, the part that has the length of the files, has gotten clobbered.
Yeah. It's now,
like, if you're nailing that part of the drive, then I would say that I'd be very concerned that other things close to that are probably kind of screwed up as well. So,
So, you know, the one thing you could try is to... Well, my guess is nothing is going to fix this drive other than a reformat. So copy everything off as best you can and reformat. However,
and you may want to try, you know, like we were just at the show, Drive Rescue is a nice thing, or one of the other.
Yeah, he said he tried Disk Warrior.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah, and that.
All right, Data Rescue may be good, but
yeah.
You may want to try, if they're critical, these are important files.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes you got to try a couple of different utilities. They each have their own strengths and weaknesses as far as how they guess at, you know, what's legitimate and what's not. So could be worth a try. Again, it depends on how important that stuff is.
For problems like this one, I would highly recommend booting into single user mode, Command S, as you restart. When you get to the command line, follow the instructions right above the command prompt for running FSCK. Mm-hmm. I know we all believe that Disk Utility, it runs the same thing as FSCK, but we have proven that to not be the case. I know everybody says that that's what happens, but I've fixed problems with FSCK that Disk Utility would not even see, let alone fix. So so it is somehow different. I don't know how, but it is. So go ahead and try that from the command line. You know, it sounds like that volume header block is the issue. So perhaps FSCK without anything else mounted on the drive can get in there and fix that. If it does fix it, copy everything off and then nuke and pave the drive. I would not believe that drive is going to last you. So, all right. So he has another
drive backup. Last thing. I'm going to toss in a little thingy here very quickly.
Yeah, go.
Okay, there's something called SMART. You may have heard of this. I forgot what it stood for. I actually have a little thing called SMART Reporter. I'll link to it in the notes. But most modern drives have a feature. I think it's a system, whatever. It's basically a feature of a drive where the drive will say, I'm happy, or I'm about to die. Could you please, you know, save me quickly. And so I have this add-on on my PowerBook, and I actually on all my machines, and it shows what the drive has to say about how it thinks it's doing. It sounds like here it could be physical. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
It could be physical damage where the drive is saying, help me, help me. And there's, you know, maybe if it gets really severe, OS X will report it on the OS level. I don't know. But they have these third-party utilities like, you know, this one here, Smart Reporter, which will say, hey, the drive is complaining that it's not happy. You better do something really quick.
Self-monitoring analysis and reporting technology for those of you
excellent.
Playing along at home. All right, so we'll go on to Dave's second backup question here. And John, I hope John has some insight here for us.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Dave from Columbus. Got a question for you. I was listening to your backup strategies or backup questions And our local micro center here has, you know, 2 and 4 gig flash drive for $20 or $30. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on, as the flash drive start to reach the current DVD limit, you know, about 4.7 gig to, you know, 4 gig on the flash drive, using the flash drives for backups versus DVDs. Anyway, thanks. Bye.
You know, my only concern with that, John, of course, would be what's the longevity on those flash drives? And I think you've got the answer for us here.
Yeah, so I did some poking around online, and you know, a lot of this is it's hard to nail it down and say 10 years, 20 years. But the research I did from a couple of semiconductor vendors hints at that these devices that use flash for storage, you're talking 10 to 20 years. Now, it's hard to say because a lot of times, a lot of these technologies haven't been out that long. Same thing right. with CDs and DVDs. Right. A lot of,
good
like
point.
CDs, I forget, Dave, the... Yeah, I mean, how do you know? I mean, if you test it, assuming that you're doing the number of read and write cycles, well, it's not really an accurate test because the time factor you can't duplicate. You could duplicate the number of reads and writes you think will happen, but that's modifying the time basis for the test. So you can make a good guess, but most people acknowledge that, you know, flash, if you do nothing, 10 to 20 years is a reasonable persistence for the data.
That's now, I mean, that's just as good as a CD, right? I mean,
for the write once media. Now, I've seen less, and this is another thing I've seen, is the trend is the write once media, that's not the RW, that's just the R media,
yeah,
will tend to last longer. Now, you know, there are dyes
longer
technologies.
Longer
than
in...
the read write technology.
Got it. Okay.
Now, I like the RWs because they're basically big, monstrous floppies.
Right.
And probably about as fast. A little faster.
Hmm.
But you got to look at this aspect. So flash,
it's all relative,
I would say,
yeah.
Flash, as long as you're not whopping on the thing and reading and writing very many times, because a lot of these memory devices do have a limit, unlike hard drives, at least I haven't seen this on hard drives, memory devices have a limit as to how many times you can read and write reliably.
Okay.
And they give this as, you know, MTBF, mean time between failures, or some other spec. So for occasional storage for within the next 10 years, I would say flash is an excellent way to you know, hedge your bets.
All right. Well, there you go.
I would still go for a hard drive for longer-term storage, or it sounds like at this point right now, based on what you and I know, Dave, that
yeah.
optical media would give you as much, and, you know, an important part here is storage. Like even I saw in the memory devices, you know, don't put it in the freezer or...
Hot, soapy
you know,
water.
Desert.
Very bad.
A lot of these
yeah.
will have conditions, and you may want to pay attention to them if you're thinking of long-term storage, is a lot of these, I mean, you know, paper is a very sensitive medium to this. Humidity and all that. Same with media.
Paper has that fire problem, too.
Yeah. Well, other things, you know, if you give them enough flame.
That's
will,
true.
But, you know,
yeah.
So optical stuff, you know, you probably want to keep it out of bright lights. You probably want to have regulated humidity and temperature just to make sure you don't put them out of spec. And if you dig deep enough, you will get the suggested values for either memory devices or disks as far as the ideal environment to keep them. And actually, I've seen another thing in backup strategies. Don't keep your backups on the same site as where you are in case something really bad happens.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a backup. Oh, it's in the building that just burned down. Whoops.
Yeah.
Have it off-site. You got these places like Iron Mountain and you know, many, many other places. You know, if you really want to protect your data, keep it off-site in a physically as far away as reasonable.
Yeah, well, you know what? What I see a lot of companies do, smaller companies, is they'll have someone, usually the reception, you know, the person kind of running, the office manager, if you will, takes, you know, if they've got, let's say they've got backup tapes or CDs, mm-hmm. if you're backing up once every day, have two sets, one for 1 week and one for the next week. And on the weekends, right. on Friday night, you take one set home with you. And mm-hmm. or maybe Friday morning, you bring one set in and take one set home Friday night, you know, however you want to manage it. But at least that way you've got, you know, backups in two different places most of the time. So, and you know, as long as you trust your office manager or whoever it is you assign yeah. that task to, you're good to go.
Yeah, but it's really cool, actually, to see. Like right now I have although it gave me a little grief earlier with that, you know, DVD mounting problem.
Yeah.
I mean, you're getting now, I think, the state of the art, I think you can get 8 gigabyte flash devices.
Yeah, of course you can. Yeah, because
they may be edging on an 8.
Well, then, I mean, the Nano is an 8. So there you go.
Okay, but I mean, it like a handheld.
Oh, I see. Like a thumb drive kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, thumb drive in that form factor. I don't know if I've seen an 8 as of yet, but I'm sure it's coming. So, yeah, that may be a great way to well, you know, I'm sure most of our listeners already carry around a little thumb or flash drive, which are just oh so fashionable. And
yep. Now I see the Supermedia Store has 16 gig flash drives.
Really?
Ooh. Yeah.
Okay.
At least that's what they say, for $330.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're paying a little bit for that. A little more than a hard
drive. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
If you spent that on a hard drive, you'd probably get a,
you'd be
a wee
set.
Bit more.
Yeah. $130 for the 8 gig, though. So, there
nice.
You go.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
you pay for the latest technology.
You do. Yeah. You want to be on the bleeding edge. It's going to hurt a little. So
are we about
I think we are.
Yeah, well, there's the band. So, I was really kind of cranky. Initially, I was going to get really cranky tonight because two of my favorite shows are both on at the same time, 24 and Heroes. Curse you, networks. But then I realized, as Dave probably did, we both have dual tuner TiVos. So to the networks, I say, well, can you put a beep sound in there?
No. We're not going to do any post-production. I'm too much in a fog as it is.
You tried to torment us, but
will beat you.
I'm recording both. So, but are you happy with the Series 3?
So far, so good. Other than the money that's missing from my pocket, but you know.
Yeah, well, I see they extended. I think they extended the
transfer
deal.
Yeah, until the end of this month. That's right. If you're going to do it, let me know, because at least we can, do a little, get TiVo points going. So let us know if you're going to do the TiVo thing. So, where am I here? Oh, yeah. So, home networking. We asked you to start sending in comments, and you've started sending them in. Send in more, because maybe next week we'll have enough to do. We probably already have enough, but send in more comments about home networking, questions, queries, concerns, anything you ever wanted to ask but were too afraid. Home networking next week.
Be afraid no longer.
That's right. Fear no longer. You can even send it in anonymously. Hi, this is Mr. X. You could even do it with the voices like Toby did this week for the audio engine thing. So. that's that. Cashfly Hosting is where you've downloaded this podcast from. In the podcast marketplace this month is the 6i Isolator earphones from Edemotic, the A5 desktop speakers from AudioEngineUSA.com, TeachMac from TeachMac.com, and Yojimbo from Barebones Software.
Yojimbo.
That's new. Backbeat Media Podcast Network is where you can get on this show. If you want to advertise this, that is. Of course, if you just want to get your comments on, we've got a whole lot of options. 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335.
That's right. MacGeekGab at MacObserver.com. Skype to MacGeekGab. If you want a snail mail address, just email us. We'll let you know.
Who uses that anymore?
I have no idea. Oh, we had somebody send us t-shirts last year. Remember that? Those cool Godfather t-shirts. If you want a snail mail address, let us know. Think very different.
We're not going to show those to the Apple lawyers. They get cranky.
No, well, we didn't pay for them. They're one of a kind.
And if you have good comments about the show or bad comments, iTunes and Podcast Alley, and you can also vote for us.
That's right. Vote early, vote often.
Just like the U.S. elections.
What?
Whoa, sorry. George is speaking tomorrow, right?
Yeah, State of the Union.
Gotta put that on the TiVo.
That's right. All right.
Oh, yeah.
That's it. I'm done. I'm going to go.
You're done?
Yeah, I'm taking NyQuil tonight. But I can't take NyQuil because it doesn't have decongestant in it, so I got to take something else. But, whatever it is. I'm done.
I think you should probably try a 120-minute IPA.
Oh. Stuff would knock me out, man. Although that's not a bad idea.
Probably not.
If you're going to keep drinking that stuff, just make sure you don't get caught.
Made up.